the very large. Now we have both, the huge and the tiny. Noah Pinter-Wollman comes from Israel, and now she's in LA. She studies ants, but started with jumbos.
So for my PhD, I studied elephants, but I soon realized, even though it was great fun, you can't really build an academic career on elephants, but I still really like social behavior. And so I thought, what would be a good social animal that I can do manipulation on? And so directly to ants.
Before you left those poor elephants, what did you find out about them?
What I looked at was a translocated elephant. So elephants that were moved from the coast of Kenya to about 100 miles away from the coast because of human-elephant conflict. And I looked at what happens to these elephants in their novel environment. So who they interact with, what they eat, where they spend their time, their stress levels. And I found out that when elephants come to a new place, they'll first form immigrant enclaves. So they will prefer to hang out with elephants that came from the same area as them. And it took them about a year to socially integrate into the society of elephants that was already there.
Makes one wonder how they knew who came from their district.
Right. I did not look at the mechanism of how they recognize each other, but we know that elephants have a very extensive vocal abilities, so maybe they have different dialects. There's many things you can speculate. Maybe they just knew them from past experiences. They have good memories. It took a while for them to get to know an established population.
And you contrast bees and ants. They don't have the lifespan to have all that experience, and they don't have the big brain. So to be social, I would have imagined, and I think most people would think the same way, that there are lots and lots and lots of little robots who've got designated roles, and they live in this fascist society, and it just sort of happens like that forever. Is it right or wrong?
Well, it's not a fascist society because there is no one ordering them around. And so even though the queen is called a queen, she doesn't give orders to anyone. All she does is lay eggs. So her role is a reproductive role. She's the only one who lays eggs in most ant societies. The workers are sterile females. So most of the ants you see in your kitchen are females. The males live a very short amount of time. They're just there to fertilize the queens. And they're not robots in the sense that nobody programs them. I mean, they do have genes, obviously, that will give them some behaviors, but they do get information from the environment, whether it's their social environment, so other ants that are around them, and the physical environment, such as constraints that they face or the resources they collect. And so they follow certain rules, and ants vary in how well they follow these rules and how well they learn things. And in terms of the lifespan, even though each individual worker may live for a very short time, from weeks to up to a year, the queen actually can live up to 40 years in some harvester ant species. And so the colony as a whole could potentially have collective memory that could persist over years, you know, because there is overlap between generations of workers and the space that they occupy develops over time. And so the memory can be embedded in the nest itself that they build or in the other ways that they shape the environment around the nest.
The space that they occupy changes and they adjust to it. How do they pass on that information? How do they organize themselves to do something so subtle?
People have been looking at what would be local rules that would result in these global patterns that we see in terms of the nest structure. And so a lot of work has actually been done in termites and how they construct their nest. And so, you know, one rule could be, I'm going to put a little pebble on a pile that I saw that's new, for example. And so that will create certain pillars. And so you can find these rules that if everyone follows them, will produce these structures. And it could be, I'm a forager, I have a seed in my mouth, I have nowhere to put it. And so I'll transfer it maybe to another ant and then we'll go dig some space, or, you know, that's a rule I just made up. I don't know if they actually do that. And then if that happens to a lot of them, because space is running out to store seeds, then you will end up with a new chamber to store seeds in. The feedback between the social processes that happen and the spatial environment that they occupy is constant, and ants are always getting feedback from their surroundings.
The one thing I cannot understand, talking about termites you mentioned just now, those great big mounds, which are twice the size of the biggest gravestone you've ever seen, and they're angled to the sun in a particular way so that the temperature is maintained. Now, we have problems with architects in Australia, in cities, trying to get the building right. How do tiny termites organize something on such a scale?
Right. I mean, again, they could be using things like the sun or polarization of the light. But just as honeybees use the orientation of the sun to navigate to resources, or there's some desert ants that use polarization of the light to navigate in the desert with no other features.
But how are you studying this question of space and these small animals?
So harvester ants that have a very interesting behavior, which is they will occasionally pick up the entire colony and move into a new nest. Colonies of thousands of workers, up to 10,000 workers sometimes, just everyone will move into a new nest. And what I do is I go and look at their collective behavior in a certain nest and wait for them to move to another nest. And then I create a cast of the old nest and compare features of that nest to the collective behavior that I quantified before they left that nest. And then when I look at the structure of the cast of the nest that I take after they moved, I quantify it using network theory where each chamber is a node and each tunnel is an edge connecting node. And I look at these networks and at their structure and I find how well connected that first chamber that ants come into when they come from the outside. So the more connected entrance chambers, the faster the recruitment.
Where I come from is the ant capital of the universe, Australia. Similar sort of organization in some bees, of course. But is it true that bees get bored?
So yes, honeybees can get bored. So the way to study it is you expose a honeybee worker to an odor many, many times, so 40 times, without associating it with anything, just spraying the odor at its antenna. And then you try to teach it to associate that particular odor with a reward, which is usually just high concentration of sugar water. And so some bees will be exposed to this odor and still, even after they've been exposed to it 40 times without any reward, will happily learn that to associate it with a reward. But some bees will say, no, I was just exposed to this 40 times. It didn't reward me. Why should I associate it with any rewards? We think of these bees as getting bored of this odor because they were exposed to it so many times without being rewarded. And so this is a lab-based essay, which we put bees, we harness them in little straws, we spray the odor at them, and then we teach them to this association. But the project that we're doing this for is to try and link this lab-based behavior to the ecology of the colony. And so the idea is that if we have this variation in the colony, maybe it has some implications for the ecology. And what could be happening, and we are starting to have evidence for this, is that the ones who get bored quickly are the explorers, and the ones who don't get bored quickly are the exploiters. And so there's always this exploration-exploitation trade-off in nature where should you spend time on looking for new resources, you might find better resources than you already know. Or should you spend time exploiting resources that are familiar to you? You know, you'll definitely get something, but maybe it's not the best thing out there. And if you're an individual animal, this trade-off, you only have so much time. You can either do this or that. But if you're a colony, at the colony level, you have many workers. And so different workers can have different strategies, and then they bring that information to the colony, and the collective as a whole can balance that trade-off more efficiently potentially than an animal that has this temporal trade-off.
Noah Pinter-Wollman is an associate professor at the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, UCLA. And I learned this week that the male version of that name would be Noach in Israel. So does that mean that Noah's Ark would have had a female captain? Gender is so tricky these days, isn't it? Just ask those bees. Next week, we shall hear from psychologists testing astronauts wanting to go to Mars. And we look at some new telescopes. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Robin Williams.
Flip your wings and fly to daddy. Flip your wings and fly to daddy. Flip your wings and fly to daddy. Fly, fly, fly to daddy. To feel the rhythm of life. To feel the powerful beat. To feel the tingle in your fingers, to feel the tingle in your feet, to feel the rhythm of life, to feel the powerful beat, to feel the tingle in your fingers, to feel the tingle in your feet.
Flip your wings and fly to daddy. Flip your wings and fly to daddy. Flip your wings and fly to daddy.
Daddy, we got the rhythm of life, the rhythm of life. Daddy, we got the rhythm of life, the rhythm of life. Daddy, we got the rhythm of life, rhythm of life, rhythm of life, rhythm of life. Doobie 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 doobie